I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this month, the State Department announced that its computer systems had been breached. This comes on the heels of breaches at the White House, the U.S. Postal Service, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It is believed that this is the work of Russian and Chinese hackers. Our guest, Shane Harris, explores the new world of cyber sabotage in his new book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. More than half a century ago, President Eisenhower warned of the rise of the military-industrial complex. Harris raises concerns and questions about privacy, mass surveillance, and security in an increasingly wired world. He's a senior correspondent at the Daily Beast, where he covers national security, intelligence, and cybersecurity. He's also an ASU Future of War Fellow at the New America Foundation. Wrote a book a couple years ago called The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. And Shane Harris, joining us from the NPR Studios in Washington. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So what is this complex, this internet complex with the military? What does that include?
So on the one hand, you have the military and the intelligence community in the United States, and primarily the National Security Agency, which is our largest intelligence agency and kind of the center of gravity of cyber warfare in the U.S. And on the other side of the alliance, you have large technology companies to include internet service providers that run the backbone of the internet in the U.S., telecommunications companies that run our cellular and phone networks, and large technology companies like Google. And what all these companies are basically cooperating with the government, sometimes willingly, sometimes compelled to do so legally, for the purposes of treating cyberspace as a battlefield. And what I mean by that is defending computer networks, but also specializing in learning how to break into them and potentially to damage infrastructure attached to those networks in other countries.
Would you say we are at war, at some kind of low-grade war in cyberspace?
Yeah, I think there is a low-grade conflict in cyberspace going on right now. It's the espionage component of this is really quite pervasive. I mean, the Chinese have become masters at hacking into American companies and stealing all manner of different trade secrets, primarily to help boost the Chinese economy. And certainly what we're seeing is activity that looks like the precursor to potential conflict insofar as we have probed power grid systems in other countries, and other countries have probed into our networks that control our power facilities. Our banking systems as well are at risk. So we see the potential for real physical, real-world consequences coming as a result of these cyber-based attacks.
Is this related to probing Angela Merkel's cell phone?
They're sort of on a spectrum, actually. I mean, so if you sort of drew a line and you had kind of surveillance at one end and actually breaking into a computer system and damaging a piece of infrastructure attached to it at the other, the Merkel activity would be sort of more towards that surveillance end of the spectrum. That's information, that are operations that are designed to gather secrets, to covertly penetrate a computer system, take information away without the person knowing. But those are the first steps that you need to complete before gaining access to a system and then causing it to break or potentially to, you know, for instance, getting into a computer system that controls a power generator that could cause the power generator to spin wildly out of control and break down. All of the getting in part is effectively surveillance, and so that's why it's on a spectrum.
You seem to trace this to September 11th, or I guess what happened after September 11th to deal with some of the security threats in the U.S. Is that where we should begin?
Yeah, I think September 11th is a good place to start. I mean, that is when the NSA and the Justice Department went to the major telecommunications providers in the U.S., you know, AT&T and other phone companies, and said, we need access to your data. We need you to give us information on your customers and who they're calling, how long those calls are lasting. And so these call records were essentially handed over without a warrant. It was really, you know, more at the command of the Attorney General and the President. And this is where you first start to see these tech companies who have this powerful, powerful information because they own the networks. The government doesn't own the networks mostly in this country, partnering up with the government and entering into this arrangement whereby the private entity will provide information to the government. And it really starts to kind of morph out from there and take on more dimensions, not just looking for terrorists, but eventually looking for hackers and for cyber spies, to the point where now this alliance is built up to effectively try to monitor the networks across the United States and prevent not only terrorist attacks, but prevent cyber attacks as well.
You describe a meeting that President Obama had shortly after taking office, where he was briefed on some of these cyber threats. And it seemed like a pretty eye-opening experience. We should say that his campaign had been hacked as he was running for president the first time. But nonetheless, here he is president learning about some of these threats.
Yeah, he came into office having had some firsthand experience with being on the end of a hack. And, you know, of course, in President Obama, it was arguably our first sort of internet campaign. You know, he was very savvy about technology, about cyberspace. I don't think he needed anybody to explain to him the vulnerabilities. But when he first met with President Bush to go over some of the classified programs and intelligence operations that Bush thought were particularly valuable and that Obama should keep, one of them was a covert cyber operation against Iran, something that later came to be known as Stuxnet, but at the time was called Olympic Games. And this was a computer virus that we built and had inserted into computer systems in an Iranian nuclear facility. And it was designed to cause centrifuges in that facility to break. So a real classic example of cyber warfare causing, you know, breaking into a computer to cause real-world physical damage. This was something that initiated under Bush, and Bush said to Obama, you need to keep this, and the president did keep it.
I mean, the president has been criticized by some who believe that he's really very much like President Bush when it comes to surveillance and using the NSA and others to data mine.
Yeah, I think there's not really a lot of distance between the two of them, at least, you know, philosophically, on the value of surveillance for national security. You know, when President Obama was running for office, he actually was opposed to a law being debated at the time that would give the NSA broader powers to surveil and also put it on a sounder legal footing. But as he got closer to winning election and was briefed by more national security officials, including some of his own advisors, he realized that if he were to win, he would want to have these powers at his disposal as well. And so he held on to them.
Would it be fair to say that President Bush, President Obama know things that we do not know, including you, Shane Harris?
Absolutely. They know vastly more than I do, that's for sure.
But, I mean, what is – and this is sort of an ongoing investigation on your part. What is it like, or how do you penetrate this very secure system, either the NSA or what we're talking about here?
I think this really what it amounts to is it's not all that different than how intelligence agencies work. I mean, I'm not breaking into anything, but I should underscore. But, you know, just talking, I have a lot of sources who work in the intelligence community, both people who are currently employed and formerly, people who work for companies that do business with the government. And really reporting a story like this is kind of an exercise in gathering lots of little pieces of information and putting the mosaic together. And there's actually a surprising amount of public information on this as well. You know, speeches that have been given by military officials that were overlooked but really quite significant when you unpack what they were saying. Regulations that have been issued that most people sort of glance over or don't even really take the time to read. But if you do dig into them, you find a lot of illuminating information that you can then kind of compile with the information you're getting from human sources.
Well, thinking of one of those human sources being, of course, Edward Snowden and his revelations about the kind of data mining that the NSA had been doing with largely the public's not knowing what was going on. Do you see this as a turning point at all?
Yeah, I do. In fact, the Snowden documents, I started writing the book before his first disclosures. And once they came out, there was a lot of information that he revealed that amplified a lot of the things that I read about in my book. And what's interesting is, you know, mostly what got attention in the Snowden files were more of the surveillance activities oriented at Americans' communications, looking for terrorist attacks or trying to help terrorism cases. But there was a lot in those files that pertained to cyber warfare operations that did not get as much coverage. And they were a real benefit to me in my research.
When you say cyber warfare, and I hate to get lost on a semantic question here, but and I use the word cyber sabotage in my introduction. So thinking about what cyber warfare would look like, is that, you know, the failure of financial systems, the failure of communication grids, things like that?
Right. I think when we talk about cyber war really taken to its ultimate kind of conclusion, that's exactly what we're talking about, is real-world effects caused by network operations. So me hacking into the computer that controls your power grid, or, you know, to put it another way, China hacking into systems that control physical facilities in the U.S. We have done this. I mean, the Stuxnet virus is probably the most well-known example. And that's what I think qualifies as cyber warfare. If it has a real-world effect, if that act of hacking or breaking into that computer has a real-world effect that you can measure, then I think it constitutes what most experts would agree is an act of cyber war.
What should we know about Chinese hackers, or what do you know about Chinese hackers, how they work?
Well, the thing that China has going for it is they have thrown a lot of people at their operations. There are thousands of hackers working for the government or sort of working quasi-independently of the government, penetrating the systems primarily of American corporations. And what they're doing here is looking for information like trade secrets, business plans, negotiating points that the Chinese hackers can then hand over to Chinese corporations to give them a leg up, particularly when they're competing with or even negotiating with American companies. I mean, I talked to some executives who would say that when they sat down at a table to negotiate a deal and sat across from their Chinese counterparts from another company, the Chinese already knew what the Americans' position was because they'd seen the talking points. The Chinese are also interested in probing our critical infrastructure facilities as well, power grids and the like. But mainly their campaign is focused on espionage to date.
And what about American hackers? And as you described, the NSA has been hiring hackers to do, I guess, our kind of dirty work.
Right. Well, we are setting up our own offensive cyber operations, principally in the NSA, but the military services each are building now their own kind of cyber divisions. And we have something called U.S. Cyber Command, which is the umbrella organization that will eventually unite all of these military activities. We don't have as many people. The goal right now is in the next couple of years to field a group of about 6,000 people who will be primarily working in defense, but also a portion of that working on the offensive side. And what the military wants to see happen is eventually for cyberspace, cyber warfare operations to be sort of indistinguishable from any other form of military operations, or, you know, not, I shouldn't say indistinguishable, but to make it not something of an outlier, but to integrate it into the way that we fight wars so that in the future a computer virus will be thought of as something in the arsenal the same way that a missile or a bomb or a torpedo is.
We're almost up on a break here, but would these hackers be working for the Department of Defense or for NSA or a combination?
Probably a combination. I mean, many of them work at NSA now, which is a Defense Department agency. But these would be Defense Department or military employees.
And that's Shane Harris. He's a senior correspondent at the Daily Beast. He covers national security, intelligence, and cybersecurity. That's what we're talking about, and that's what he writes about in his new book. It's called At War, and it's subtitled The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines for your questions or comments. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Shane Harris, author of this new book called At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So, Shane, should we think of the NSA as our friend or our foe?
Well, they have kind of conflicting missions.
They do, you know? Don't they?
They really do. They have sort of two missions. They're sort of bifurcated. So on the one hand, you know, look, the NSA is the center of expertise that can help defend computer networks in this country, and I think can work with industry to do that as well. On the other, it has an offensive mission. It has a spying mission. And the things that it has to do to be able to spy and to attack fundamentally weaken defenses and security on the internet and in the products that we all use. It is both in a sense. And I think that's something that's a real source of tension and conflict that we're going to have to work out in the years to come.
In fact, you say that kind of tension and conflict between the NSA and the State Department, their missions really look like they could be on, or perhaps they are on, some kind of a collision course when it comes to some of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that, you know, within the government bureaucracy, there are lots of agencies that are frequently working at cross purposes with each other. I mean, I think that the collision could come from that if the NSA continues to go down this path of trying to find weaknesses in computer systems and hoarding information about weaknesses that it's aware of rather than disclosing them and letting companies better protect those systems. You know, if there's a major cyber attack in the United States, it could be because of a weakness in our networks that the NSA knew about but chose not to disclose because it wanted to keep that information for its own purposes. Because remember, a lot of the equipment that we're talking about that this agency is looking to hack and break into is used all around the world. So a weakness in a system that controls our power grid here might be a weakness that exists in the systems that control the power grid in Iran. And so the NSA, if it finds that information, it has to ask itself, do we disclose that to protect our networks or do we keep it secret so we have a way into the Iranian network? And that's a balance that's being exercised entirely in a classified setting right now. There's really no public debate about that.
Let me quote something from your book. You write, over the past few years, the State Department has given millions of dollars to support Tor, and that's so people can communicate anonymously, and has encouraged its use against, its use by activists and dissidents abroad, including rebels in Syria fighting in a grueling civil war to overthrow the strongman Bashar al-Assad. The NSA knew that the State Department was promoting Tor, and it attacked Tor anyway. I think that's what I want to get sort of a little deeper into these cross purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Tor is a great example. I mean, this is a system that it can be very difficult to use. But if you are someone who's operating in a country where the networks are being constantly surveilled by the government, like Syria, it can be something that can help you stay alive. Really, you can communicate without being detected, and people and the authorities won't know where you are. Tor was actually developed in part by a Navy research program, which is even another level of irony that the Defense Department had a role in this. But the State Department has encouraged dissidents, has encouraged rebel groups to use this technology. It's part of what Secretary Clinton called her Internet Freedom Agenda. And then we find out that while one arm of the government is encouraging people to use this technology in order to keep themselves anonymous, the NSA is researching ways to break Tor and find out where people are who are using that network. So exactly the opposite, and in behaving in some ways, frankly, like people might accuse the oppressive regimes of behaving, trying to penetrate it. And, you know, those are just two completely conflicting missions, and there's really no one who's been responsible in government for saying, okay, let's step back and really figure out what is our priority here. Just the opposite has happened. These, you know, both bureaucracies have sort of gone out and pursued their various goals independent of one another. And you know, Syria is a great example of where you see those two goals colliding.
Wouldn't that be a job of the White House or the president himself to sort of negotiate whatever the sort of conflicting uses of this cyber stuff?
Yeah, you put your finger on something there, too. I mean, right now there is nominally a White House cybersecurity czar. We have these umpteen czars that we have, who is responsible for, in theory, coordinating a lot of these activities. But not at the reality is that the NSA and the Defense Department have been largely left to kind of go pursue this on their own. And the White House and the National Security Council hasn't really exercised a lot of what the military or what the government likes to call deconflicting of these various goals. That's something that's going to have to happen, though, because the more that cyber warfare becomes commonplace and integrated into how the military fights, the more important it's going to be to get this balance right. This has heretofore been something that's largely been handled by secret corners of bureaucracy, but it's becoming more reality, and other countries are pursuing it as well.
Well, you had a piece recently about ISIS. I'm reading the headline, ISIS keeps getting better at dodging U.S. spies. And as we know, ISIS has been able to use the internet to recruit members of their terrorist organization. How do you see, and ISIS, I think, is a good example of this sort of asymmetrical warfare.
Yeah, ISIS has made really good use of, so all good is
perverse,
sort of a loaded term. Yeah, exactly. Effective, let's say. use of cyberspace to recruit, to push out social media, to spread these really gruesome beheading videos. They've also become very quick studies in surveillance and how to avoid it. So they're doing things like avoiding the use of cell phones, when they send out tweets, stripping out the information that shows where the tweeter is geographically located. They're using encryption now to shield their communication so that even if they are intercepted, it's very difficult to unencrypt them and find out what they were saying. And so a lot of this is sort of like is a good encapsulation of what our cyber surveillance apparatus is up against. Mm. Right as we develop a way to intercept someone's communications and monitor them, that's a perishable technique. As soon as somebody figures out how to counter it, our spies have to figure out a new way to gather to intercept the adversary's communications. It's very much a cat and mouse game. And ISIS has been much more technologically savvy than their predecessors were or that Al-Qaeda has been.
How come? And you write about Al-Qaeda during the Iraq War and how Petraeus used some of this technology to go after Al-Qaeda.
Right. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which of course was the predecessor to ISIS, the NSA and the military used cyber techniques to monitor them, to geographically locate them, round them up, capture and kill people, used to great effect in 2007 and 2008 in the surge. I think this next incarnation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, known as ISIS, is just more technologically savvy. Some of them are younger. I think they have more examples of having seen how we now sort of understand even culturally that the government can monitor communications and can use that to physically locate someone. I think just over time, as society has gotten smarter, this knowledge becomes more commonplace, and it's no different with ISIS. They've just figured out, you know, hey, the military and the intelligence community, the Americans are going to monitor us by our phones. We should stay off the phones.
It seems to me intelligence is always a cat and mouse game. It just seems that it's happening so much faster these days because the internet is so much faster.
I think that's right, and the technology develops so quickly as well. And you know, and for the NSA, this is something that it's a constant challenge for them. They're always in a race to keep up with it, and it's actually one of the reasons why I'm very skeptical of the insistence by a number of intelligence officials that the Edward Snowden's disclosures devastated U.S. intelligence gathering capabilities. I have no doubt that they had some effect, but it's also the case that because of the way this technology evolves, every few years you have to keep coming up with new ways of spying. So they, in effect, were going to have to develop new capabilities anyway.
Even going back to this article you wrote about ISIS, one of the things that they have done to get around the kind of cyber spying by the U.S. is to use couriers. And I know that was also true with Osama bin Laden. They were using couriers rather than cell phones to pass messages, which is what, almost medieval.
Yeah. I mean, bin Laden, you know, now that we know more about details about where he was hiding in Abbottabad, I mean, he was exercising tremendous security with his communications. The house that he was in had no connection to the internet. Cell phones were not allowed. Only the couriers were used. It's one reason why I think it took so many years to track him down.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Shane Harris, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about cyber warfare, the subject of his new book called At War, and it's subtitled The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. And he writes about national security, cybersecurity for The Daily Beast, joining us from the studios in Washington, the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have an email from Gary. He says, what recommendations can you give the NSA, as there are so many countries wanting to take the U.S. down? Can there be a balanced approach?
Well, I think the balance may come from diplomacy and negotiations, frankly. I mean, what needs to happen is that our military needs to be having discussions with other large militaries like the Chinese, the Russians, about what the rules of the road or the rules of engagement are going to be in cyberspace. Right now, a lot of these other countries that are developing their own cyber forces don't have a great incentive to do that because they want to be able to keep us off our balance. But that's where this is going to have to go. We're going to have a much more public country-to-country discussion about norms of behavior and what's acceptable and what would constitute an act of cyber aggression that would merit a response.
But in many ways, we're not fighting countries. We're fighting groups and organizations.
We are, but we're also going to fight countries' militaries in cyberspace. I mean, the real, I think, predicament comes not when you are dealing with a large nation state, which may have a lot of incentives not to attack us, but if a rogue country like an Iran or a North Korea or even a terrorist organization were to develop these capabilities, how would you negotiate with them? How would you even know who was responsible for the attack, which is generally true in cyberspace as well? This, I think, is probably where U.S. national security officials find the tougher dilemma is how those rogue actors, how do you deal with them?
Well, and cyberspace doesn't have the same kind of borders and boundaries that we have here on Earth.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
So do you and actually there was an article I saw recently, in fact, maybe this morning or over the weekend from the BBC, saying a leading company, a security company called Symantec, says that there's a bug named Regin, R-E-G-I-N, mm-hmm. probably created by a government, has been used for 6 years against a range of targets around the world. Once installed in a computer, it can do things like capture screenshots, steal passwords, and recover deleted files. Experts say computers in Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Ireland have been hit most. Is this really what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the Regin malware appears to be something very similar to the Stuxnet virus that the U.S. created, which was used against Iran. And what is troubling about it from the initial reports is that it is a piece of malware that is customizable. And what we mean by that is that you can load onto it different payloads, they call them, to make it more appropriate for attacking, let's say, an electrical system. Or you can switch out the payload and make it better for attacking a bank. It's sort of a modifiable weapon. And from what Symantec's analysis tells it is that it probably took years to develop,
wow.
which indicates that it was built by a country. And since there are no known infections of it in the U.S. or China, that sort of leads you to conclude that it was one of those two countries that built it. It looks very similar to the Stuxnet virus, which is how I think that, you know, at least the odds are right now that it's probably points towards something being something that the U.S. developed. But we have no confirmation on that yet.
Talk a bit about Keith Alexander. You have written quite a bit about him and used to head up the NSA. What should we know about him?
So he was the longest-serving director of the National Security Agency in the agency's history. He retired as a 4-star general in the Army, and he was also the head of U.S. Cyber Command, which is this umbrella group I talked about that is supposed to coordinate all the Defense Department's and the military's activities. Alexander is important because he really took over the NSA at a time when it began to define its mission in cyberspace and when NSA became the center of the action in government around cyber defense and around cyber offense. And he had a real vision, and still does, for the government playing a central role in protecting cyberspace as a national security priority. And through his leadership, the NSA achieved tremendous power and influence in Washington. He oversaw many of the more expansive surveillance systems that Edward Snowden revealed. And really, I think it can be credited with seeing the NSA through its first entry into cyber warfare. He was somebody who believed very much in the power of this kind of warfare to change the way we fight even before he became the director of the NSA. He has a technical background. He is a career intelligence officer. Very, very rare for a career intelligence officer to rise to the level of a 4-star general. That's a huge achievement. So a very powerful and influential figure in this whole story.
You do raise some questions about some investing he did and you know, whether he had inside information on some of these investments.
So it came out after he left government a few months back. His financial disclosure forms were released after a lawsuit by an investigative reporter. And what it showed was that he was investing in some technology companies, including one that had a deal with AT&T, AT&T being one of the most important partners in what I call the military internet complex because it provides information on its customers to the NSA. It just raised a lot of questions about why was he investing in technology companies that were so closely related to the business that he was in, that of surveillance and data mining. Also investing in some strange natural resources like potash and aluminum, which had connections to China and Russia, which, of course, are two of the NSA's primary targets. So just very strange and unusual to see someone, a 4-star general running an intelligence agency, also kind of having this I guess, moonlighting in his spare time as a bit of a day trader, which is very unusual.
I mean, does it raise questions about legality or illegality? Or
It raises them insofar as that all of these transactions had to be reviewed by law by an ethics official at the NSA. And someone did review them, and they were signed off. You can see that in the documents. What we don't know is how closely the individual transactions were scrutinized and what information was used to determine that there was no conflict of interest. Certainly the political optics of it are, you know, at the very least, they raise a few eyebrows. And what's interesting is that the NSA resisted releasing these documents. Initially, they claimed that to do so would reveal sensitive national security information. And never mind that lots of other officials have to reveal their financial disclosures, by the way. So it took a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit even to get the information out.
The NSA used to be known as No Such Agency. Do I have that right?
That's right.
I mean, back in the olden days, I guess. I mean, you cannot say that about the NSA anymore.
No, it's certainly one of the more well-known agencies. And when they were taking their licks during the Snowden leaks, lots of people in the CIA were sort of having a bit of schadenfreude. Usually it's the CIA that comes in for so much criticism.
Oh, another example of the departments, I guess, at each other's throats in
sure.
certain kinds of ways. NSA is then under the Department of Defense.
That's right.
And so answers to the
Well, ultimately, it answers to the Secretary of Defense and up to the President. But, I mean, the NSA has become such an important player in our intelligence and military operations that the NSA director frequently has a good personal relationship with the President directly. Keith Alexander, you know, certainly had one with President mm-hmm. Bush, less so close with President Obama. But, yes, nominally, the NSA is a Defense Department intelligence agency.
We're hearing news that President Obama is going to make some kind of announcement, maybe even say that Chuck Hagel will be stepping down as head of DOD. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's looking like that is confirmed now. Chuck Hagel is going to step down as defense secretary. He's had a brief and fairly rocky tenure, which has seen the military trying to manage crises from Ebola to ISIS. So this is going to be, you know, an interesting pick down to see who the president chooses to replace him. There's actually a number of candidates who've been on the short list for a while, one of whom was the former number three official at the Pentagon and would be the first woman if she were Wow. confirmed as Secretary of Defense, Michelle Flournoy. So, this is one of these moments where suddenly now everybody in Washington sort of starts, you know, trying to read the tea leaves and trying to understand what the backstory was for why Hagel left.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Shane Harris is our guest. He's a senior correspondent at the Daily Beast. He covers national security, intelligence, and cybersecurity. That's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Author of a new book called At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Shane Harris. And just a recap here, in his new book, At War, he explains how the modern battlefields of war have moved into the digital realm. He's a senior correspondent for the Daily Beast, and the book traces the buildup of this military internet complex from 9/11 to today. Also about the partnership between the Department of Defense, including the NSA, private defense contractors, financial institutions, and telecommunications companies. He also raises some important and sometimes disturbing questions about how the cyber warfare is affecting you, American citizens, including some of these revelations about NSA mass surveillance. And again, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We have a question from Michael from Wynwood. He says, is the NSA's focus on its offensive capabilities rather than their defensive ones? Is that a hedged bet? Do you know the answer to that, Shane?
Well, I think that they prefer certainly to talk about their defensive capabilities more than their offensive ones. The line between defense and offense, though, in cyberspace is really not all that significant. If you know how to defend a network because you can spot vulnerabilities in it, you know how to go find vulnerabilities in another network. So in a way, it's not so much hedging as much as mm-hmm. I think that it's that the defense and the offense just simply go hand in hand. And when you develop one capability, you are naturally going to develop the other one.
Is there any way to know whether the U.S. is going after communication systems or energy grids in other countries?
Well, sources I talked to have said that we have developed those capabilities. I don't believe that we have used them. And certainly the Snowden documents reveal a lot about the efforts that we've made to spy on other governments, on foreign governments, including their corporations. So I think that we can feel very confident that if the NSA is saying, you know, worrying publicly about something that someone could do to us in this country, we've probably figured out a way to do it to them as well. And, you know, it's important to remember, too, that by talking about this publicly, the NSA and other government officials, too, are signaling to other countries, look, we know that you're doing this and don't underestimate us. You know that we have these capabilities, too. So in a way, everyone is sort of signaling to each other that they have the ability to attack if needs be.
Was it hard to get people to talk to you for this book?
It wasn't easy, but I mean, I think, you know, once you're on this beat for a long time and you start to develop relationships with people, the conversations certainly become a lot easier. But I was not able to identify by name a lot of people in this book. Yeah, simply because they we're at a time right now where the administration has been cracking down on people who talk to reporters and investigating reporters to some extent as well. And people are very nervous in Washington. It's palpable. A lot of sources that I have talked to much more freely in the past are much more reluctant to talk now because they're afraid of being discovered.
I mean, a real chilling effect then, obviously.
It has had one, yeah. Conversely, though, it's strange. After the Snowden revelations, NSA became more public, I guess, at very senior levels. It was interesting to see some of the more top-level people, the number one and two at the NSA, being much more ready to give interviews and go on television. So they of course, felt that they were on the defense there and had to come out and speak for themselves. So it did cause some people, at least, in the intelligence community to be a little more forthcoming.
Let me quote again from your book. You say the NSA and private security companies have a symbiotic relationship. Spell that out for us.
Well, what happens is, you know, you have these people who work for the NSA who learn cybersecurity and analysis techniques. They then leave government and go open up private companies that specialize in doing many of the same kinds of things, analyzing threats to networks, monitoring hacker groups, doing analysis of malware. They then produce reports that are either public or in some cases shared initially with the government. So the government is then benefiting from the expertise and the products of its former employees. I was really surprised after I finished the research for this book. It's something I didn't quite appreciate when I started, the extent to which so many people have moved out of the government space and into private industry and are setting up private organizations that do many of the same kinds of things from the analytic perspective, not the attack perspective, that the NSA does, and that are producing intelligence reports that look like something that 5 years ago you would have only seen in a classified setting. It's extraordinary just how much information these private companies have been able to produce. And the government does benefit from that analysis, too.
Does that mean they're sort of leading the charge on this, or it just complicates this relationship between these cybersecurity companies and the government?
I think they're sort of starting to lead the charge. I mean, in some respects, the NSA is okay with that. The agency knows, and the whole of government knows this, that it cannot protect every sector of the economy, every corporation, every bit of the network. So at some point, companies are going to have to defend themselves, and companies that aren't going to have their own private cyber operations in-house are going to rely on – they're going to outsource that to other companies that have expertise. So to some degree, it does help the defensive mission. Where it gets a little bit tricky is what happens when these private companies start to advise their clients about ways to hack back at the people who are attacking them, which is illegal. But you start talking – you get into these areas of self-defense. If I'm a company whose secrets are being stolen by China, why should I have to sit back and let it happen? I wouldn't let an intruder come into my house unchallenged. Why do I have to let him come into my network unchallenged?
Let me read an email. This is from Gary, a different Gary. He says, doesn't it seem odd that government agencies and major corporations place their most sensitive data and operations at the mercy of a network architecture, the internet, that was not designed to be secure, and the protocols of which have been publicly known for decades? I don't see the world banking system doing that. Their SWIFT network uses robust protocols and a proprietary architecture almost impossible to crack. Can you take a crack at that, Shane?
Sure. Yeah, it sounds like Gary knows the things.
Yeah, more than I know.
No, he's absolutely right. I mean, the internet was not designed with security in mind. It was not designed to defend against these kinds of persistent threats from nation states. And so he raises a great question. Why do we have portions of our power grid being run by control systems that can be accessed via the internet? Right. It seems to not make any sense given their vulnerabilities. There were good reasons to begin with, efficiencies, and it's easier to run them, et cetera. But other companies have realized that that's a no-go. I interviewed a number of financial executives for the book who point out that the major trading systems, you know, your NASDAQs, your New York Stock Exchange, they're not completely disconnected, but many of these things are very hard to get to. And there are some sensitive financial systems that are simply taken off the internet, just the same way that there are military networks that are taken off the internet. So we should probably be thinking more deeply about our really, really sensitive systems and whether mm-hmm. we want them to be able to be remotely accessed.
Well, and that's an important conversation to be had. Is it taking place anywhere inside government, for instance?
It is, yeah. What you're hearing more, particularly around the electrical sector, because electricity is regulated by a number of different state entities and other entities across the country, it's difficult to kind of wrangle them all together. But you are hearing more of a conversation about that right now. You know, nobody wants to sacrifice the efficiencies and the savings and, you know, that you get from connecting some of these systems via a network. But yes, that conversation is happening, as well as how do we better defend against the threats that we know about out there. I don't think you're going to see, though, kind of simply unplugging as the ultimate defense. That would just be too drastic, I think.
And that's Shane Harris again, a senior correspondent at the Daily News, the Daily Beast, and author of a new book we're talking about called At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We've got some emails here as well at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times about what you think about what we're talking about and whether this is of concern to you. Probably everybody quoted from Eisenhower in introducing you, Shane Harris, and your book. Do you see some parallels to the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about and what we're talking about, the military cyber complex?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, President Eisenhower was describing these two massive organizations coming together and creating a new kind of very pervasive influence over the way that we defended the country and how we thought of fighting wars. And I think that's true as well in this context. It's just that instead of having, you know, just defense contractors and weapons designers, although you have some of them in the mix too, you're talking about tech companies. And what Eisenhower was really concerned about was that he felt that this was something that kind of happened without a lot of conversation. I was very struck by the fact that, you know, a man who had been the supreme Allied commander in Europe and helped lead our forces in World War II, and then became commander-in-chief of the military, talked about seeing a military that he didn't recognize anymore. And I thought that was really quite stunning. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is kind of happening in cyberspace as well, that this has just evolved very quickly without a lot of notice. And now we are suddenly talking about fighting in a fifth domain of warfare. When did that happen and how? And that's what I really try to answer in the book.
You also write about Apple and Android, Microsoft. I mean, these are companies that are very intimately involved in what we're talking about, but they don't always go along with what the government wants them to do.
That's right. When it comes to revealing particular information about their customers, so individual emails, messages, phone calls, they will only do that when they're presented with a warrant. And some of these companies have pushed back even against the law that allows the NSA to gather up large amounts of communications at once. So Yahoo is one that we know that has challenged this in court, but ultimately didn't prevail. So in some instances, you do have in this alliance companies willingly participating because they think it's in their best interest. But in others, when it comes to revealing too much information about their customers, sort of pulling back. So this alliance is actually a rather tenuous one.
So what do you see the future of war? I mean, what will it look like?
I think that when we go to battle with other nations or even with, you know, insurgent groups, you're going to see cyber becoming more integrated, a kind of component to it. So it'll be, you know, we have our land forces, we have our air assault, we have the Navy's role, and then there will just be a role for the cyber operators in that. And I think as time goes on, they will be seen as less novel. And it's just more sort of common sense. Well, of course we're there. Of course we attack networks and things attached to them. And that's where you see it taking over in this new generation in the military of people who are the ones coming up now are the people who are in their late 20s, early 30s, who grew up with this technology. I mean, they're sort of a millennial generation. And they don't see it it as strange at all that you would talk about operating in cyberspace like a battlefield like any other.
Do you see drones as part of the fact that we're more willing to use drones than fighter jets these days?
Yeah, absolutely. And drones and cyber attacks have a lot in common in that they're remote. They allow you to stand back and execute an attack without having to put troops in harm's way. That's another reason why cyber operations are so attractive to the military. It minimizes risk to a great degree to our forces.
We have an email from Nikki. Says, are there matters? This is to you, Shane. Are there matters that you would not report on if you learned about them because of their sensitivity?
Sure, yeah. And then we face this all the time as national security reporters. I avoid talking about operations that would implicate individuals, that could get individuals killed. I took care to avoid anything too specific about technical details in this book. And some of the operations that I write about, particularly in Iraq, that were so effective happened a number of years ago and have actually been discussed by senior officials. So I don't think that's terribly sensitive. But yeah, I think I look at all of this information and make the decision on what is appropriate to disclose and when is it perhaps best to exercise some prudence and hold back some of that information. But generally speaking, I should say that what you see in the book, these are discussions that are being had in Washington right now, and I don't think that anything in this is that I've revealed is jeopardizing national security, and I don't think the people who talked to me were either.
I want to pick up on something you said earlier about Chuck Hagel. As I said, it looks like the president either is or will be giving an announcement about the fact that Chuck Hagel is moving on as head of the Defense Department. You described it as a rocky tenure he had. Rocky, how so?
Yeah, I think he, you know, from his very first appearance in his confirmation hearing seemed to be just a little thrown off and not quite always quite on the ball. You're hearing, too, just in the past hour or so, kind of two conflicting narratives about this coming out. One from, and this is all on background from people, obviously, but the White House sort of complaining that he never, you know, took the reins, that the military's response to ISIS and to Ebola was fumbled. And from the Hagel supporter side, you're hearing that the White House was micromanaging and that it was not really exercising leadership of its own, of the establishment. You know, Hagel just never seemed to really cotton to the job, I think. And I don't know that he ever really wrested authority from the bureaucracy. He never really seemed to be in his skin to me.
Well, and others have talked about the bureaucracy at the Department of State, or excuse me, at the Defense Department.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's any Pentagon secretary who comes in has to be a master corporate manager to some degree. It is a huge bureaucracy. Leon Panetta obviously was adept at that. I think Hagel just is not perhaps a completely skilled manager in that regard. I mean, I think, you know, by many accounts, a brilliant legislator, very effective in that setting. But perhaps this was just not his game, I guess. And, you know, look, there are so many international crises going on right now. And quite frankly, I don't think the White House has exercised really authoritative leadership. So it certainly can't all be blamed the world's problems on Chuck Hagel.
Well, it's interesting to blame him for how the U.S. handled or mishandled Ebola, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this seems like something where the criticism would be more directed at the White House. But I guess there's been a perception that, well, maybe the military didn't respond quickly enough. Mm. You know, this is the classic blame game that happens when somebody in a senior cabinet position resigns or goes down. There's a lot of face saving and a lot of backbiting that goes on at the same time.
Well, it seems you have a lot to cover down there in Washington, Shane Harris. This is your second book dealing with the surveillance state, as you called it in your first book.
Yes. Yeah, it's really kind of a job security program.
Is that what it is?
I don't really run out of things. The material seems to kind of have a life of its own, so
indeed.
I'm in good shape.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
I really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks.
Me as well. And again, Shane Harris, our guest, his new book is called At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Wrote a previous book called The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. And he's a correspondent for The Daily Beast. He covers national security, intelligence, cybersecurity. And we were just talking about the fact that there is an announcement or will be an announcement very soon that President Obama is making a change at the head of the Defense Department. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.